In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Wednesday, October 22nd, 2014. And we're talking about ending the Fed, yes, but specifically about what replaces it. Somebody's got to issue the money. Who's that going to be? Are we just trying to go back to the gold standard? Or are we looking at something much more sweeping? Joining me to talk about this today is Professor Jeff Herbener, chairman of the Department of Economics at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, where Hans Senholtz once taught, by the way. Grove City is always ranked as one of these top small liberal arts colleges. It's a wonderful place. Of course, it has Jeff as the department chairman. How much better could it get? Jeff is also the associate editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. And let me tell you something. I've known Jeff for over 20 years, and I've been asking him questions about economics, and I have never stumped him. So incidentally, when I started my website, libertyclassroom.com, I said, well, I want Jeff Herbener teaching economics, because I myself would have given my right arm to study under this guy when I was an undergrad. And now you guys have the chance to do that. Plus, you can do what I've done. You can ask him all the questions you want. All the questions you want for a year over at libertyclassroom.com. And he will answer them. And he's very thorough. It's fantastic. So anytime you're getting some crazy nonsense from somebody and you don't know how to answer it, just go to your ace in the hole, Jeff Herbener, at libertyclassroom.com in the discussion forums. Of course, you can get the courses and all that stuff. 11 courses we've got there over at libertyclassroom.com. Take 50% off with coupon code AUSTRIAN in all caps. Jeff Herbener, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
A lot of times people talk about ending the Fed. Well, a lot of times in our circles anyway. But it's less clear what would come next. What do they want to replace the Fed with? Now, I'm not interested in people who want to replace the Fed with having the federal government issue the money directly so that Nancy Pelosi can issue the money for us. That couldn't be less interested in that. Talk about missing the point completely. I'm interested in the different proposals that have been advanced by free market economists, but specifically your proposal, which is not the same thing as saying, let's go back to the gold standard. What's wrong with saying, let's go back to the gold standard? Fiat money has yielded us debasement and has yielded us the boom-bust cycle. Why don't we just go back to the gold standard? Why is that not a good solution?
Right. Well, it all depends upon, of course, what we mean by the gold standard. There have been many different gold standards in history, and the usual meaning of that by the proponents is to go back to what's called the classical gold standard of the 19th century. But the problem with that system is that the government under that system could, in fact, and did issue fiduciary media, that is, unbacked claims to money. So the treasury certificates produced in that system were only fractionally backed by a reserve of gold money. So a better system, of course, and what those of us on our side want to go to is a completely private production of money. So we just want to, as Hayek said, denationalize money, take it completely out of the hands of the state and turn it over to private enterprise. And then the problem becomes, what do we do in the transition? That becomes a difficult question. How do we transition to this system? But it, hopefully it's not too hard for our listeners, at least, to see the advantages of private production of money.
Let me note to everybody that you can Google an old blog post of mine. I'll try and remember to link to it in the show notes. Maybe I will. Return to gold. I'm going to write myself a note here because my memory isn't what it once was. But I have a blog post called How to Return to Gold, and what I've done is linked to some of the proposals by well-known economists like, Hazlitt, Rothbard, and some others. But here, with what Jeff is going to be talking about today, about having a complete and utter separation of money and state and how that would actually work, you can check that out at tomwoods.com/money. Because there, in fact, why don't you tell us about the circumstances here? You delivered just the most astonishing, elegant overview of exactly what the separation of money and state would look like. You delivered this in the most unlikely of places. Let's take a digression for a moment for you to tell us about that.
Right. We was invited to testify by Ron Paul on his subcommittee on money in Congress, and Peter Klein and I were on the panel, and Peter presented kind of a efficiency of organization, why private enterprise is a more efficient organization for production of money compared to bureaucratic production. And I offered a more social analysis of the characteristics of production generally, and then applied this to money. So basically my point was that if we want to maintain private property and the morality of the private property system and the efficiency of production in the market economy that stems from that, we need to see that this efficiency depends upon the value of what's produced relative to its cost. And so if we apply this basic notion to money production, the efficient, or we might say the optimal amount of money to produce in the economy would be that amount that's profitable to produce, just like the optimal amount of men's dress shoes is the amount that's profitable, made profitable by our demands. And so money is no different in this respect, or at least it doesn't need to be any different in this respect. It can be produced and integrated into the general production system of the market. And this is, the advantage of private production.
I think it's easy for people to see how shoe production can be profitable. You look at your inputs and, you discount it by the interest rate and stuff like that. And you evaluate whether you've earned money or lost money, and then you say whether or not your shoe business is profitable. But you're doing that in terms of money. Now, money itself, it seems hard to imagine how this would work for money itself. How do I figure out costs and how do I make a profit, in other words, in effect selling money? How do I sell money? How does this work?
Right, yeah, okay. So it works in the following way. Of course, the cost side is fairly apparent. So we have cost of production of gold coins. There has to be a mining operation and then a minting facility, and the labor is hired and the capital equipment and so on. So that, again, is no different from any other business. So that side seems fairly clear. There is sometimes there is a difference on the selling side of money. So if I have a business and I produce men's dress shoes, the way I generate revenue is I sell the shoes for money, and then the money stream revenue appears on my accounts. And I compare that to my cost. But if I'm producing money, I just have the money. And so the revenue stream is the money, is my output. The only difference is I don't have to sell the money in order to generate monetary revenue. So that step is missing. But aside from that, it's exactly the same accounting technique. I produce the gold coins, and that is my revenue. And then I compare that to my cost of production.
All right, that is going to be the key to answering my follow-up question, which would be, if the money then is your compensation, the product that you're producing is your compensation, what would stop you from just producing it without limit?
Right. As I produce more and more of this money, then the prices of my inputs would be bid up by the monetary expansion. And so they're just like in any other process in the market, there's a self-correcting dynamic that eliminates the profit of further production. So again, it would be exactly the same as for men's dress shoes. If it was wildly profitable to produce a new style of men's dress shoes, that profit would be eroded away by the adjustment process of resources in the market. Because as I produce more and more of the output of men's dress shoes, the price will moderate at which I can get. So if I'm producing more money, the actual purchasing power of the money will fall and this will moderate my profit. And then, of course, in men's dress shoes, I'd be bidding more intensely, and my competing firms with me would be bidding more intensely to buy the input, and they'd bid input prices up. So the same thing would happen in mining and gold production. If it were wildly profitable to produce more gold coins, then entrepreneurs would rush in to do this. They'd bid up the input prices, and their extra production of the money would moderate the actual purchasing power of value of the money.
And so just as with any other good, you get to a point at which it's not profitable to keep on producing. You reach a point at which it makes sense to stop, in the same way that, as you say, I wouldn't keep producing dress shoes until there was just no room for them anymore, and everybody would have, if they wanted to, 20 pairs of shoes available for them on the shelves. It regulates itself. Now, you said you were talking about the costs associated with mining and with coining gold coins. But now all my questions are devil's advocate here. Who says they have to be gold coins? Who says there has to be any mining involved at all? Mm-hmm. Why can't bank so-and-so just start creating pieces of paper?
Right. So on the production of money substitutes, then again, we have to have, or we would advocate at least, a system where private property is left intact. And so here with money substitutes, these are like checking account balances or banknotes or things of this sort. These are just legal claims to money. And so they too cannot be expanded beyond the base money supply, since they're nothing more than legal claims to money. And in a private property system, we can't have multiple legal claims to the same piece of property. So this would seem to rule out on-demand, at-par legal claims to money, or what we call money substitutes, having a fraction of reserve, where the bank, again, like in our system, can just almost indefinitely increase these fractional reserve-backed checking account balances because it's indefinitely profitable to produce more and more of them. But in a purely private system, it would not, because in order to issue the checking account, you would also have to buy or secure a gold coin for a reserve against that checking account deposit dollar for dollar.
All right, well, that's a topic we'll have to talk about separately. I'll have to have you on sometime down the road. We'll talk about fractional reserve banking as a separate topic, and
sure,
and we can talk about it as a legal question, but I'm really interested in it as an economic question and what the consequences of it are. I think Joe Sixpack on the street is inclined to say this would be an inefficient system, and he means inefficient in the colloquial sense, that there would be a lot of suppliers of money, whereas today, yep, there are problems with there being the one coercive supplier, but at least there's uniformity. I know that this is a dollar bill, and I know how much it commands, but wouldn't I be likely in this system to get all different kinds of money? Now you could come back and say, well, they'll all be money substitutes for some weight of gold, but are we saying that it's ruled out a priori by the way the question is going to be framed legally, that you could have some people issuing money that isn't fully backed?
To take a slightly different tack on answering this question, it is possible. I didn't mean to limit the competitive activity of the entrepreneurs in a private system to just gold. Of course, this is just an entrepreneurial decision as to what would best cater to people's demands for a medium of exchange. So there could be gold coins, silver coins, platinum coins, so on. There could be various forms of bank deposits that serve as highly liquid assets and so on and so forth. So we'd have this open competitive system where everything was consistent with private property. We could have electronic money substitutes. We could have cryptocurrencies. Entrepreneurs could try those out and see whether people would demand them and so on and so forth. So it is true that in an open private enterprise market, we get competition and we get competing products, and there is some variation that would have to be dealt with. But there's also, with respect to money, there's also a tendency for people to prefer uniformity in the basic money. And this is because of doing accounting and the need to engage in economic calculation, and the difficulty of engaging in economic calculation with multiple monies. And so there, the anticipation would be that people would, in fact, demand a more uniform, a less diverse set of things as money proper.
So, in other words, the thing that's backing it, whether gold or whatever else,
right.
And then that would make, even if you did have different money substitutes, it would just be a matter of simple arithmetic to compare them. Even
right.
though, even in the situation that we have now, where you have a coercively imposed system in which different countries have different monopoly monies, nevertheless, even then, private enterprise has figured out more or less how to deal with that. When you're a tourist, for example, you can take out your MasterCard and spend it in some country where they use a different currency, and you'll be billed for it in your own currency. I mean, it's not a perfect solution, but it's something. It's the way the market has dealt with the government situation that it's been given.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. So when we see a proliferation of these kinds of financial innovations that would cater to people who have these problems as solutions to these problems, that's right. That again, is the big advantage of a private enterprise system in the economic sense.
Before we go any further, I want you to explain the principle that Austrians talk a lot about and that David Ricardo talked about, namely that any supply of money is optimal. I'm not even going to elaborate on that. Can you explain that to the audience?
Right. Well, here the economists are using the word optimal in a very technical sense, as opposed to what we've been talking about, which is better called efficient. There's an efficient amount of the production of something that's determined by its profitability, but this idea of the optimal amount of money refers to simply a technical feature of money, which is that any supply of money beyond a technically feasible amount is sufficient for all the trades that people wish to do in society. That's because if you had, let's say, twice as much money in the hands of everyone, then roughly speaking, they'd engage in all of their trades at prices twice as high. So if you had half as much money distributed to the people, they could conduct all their transactions again as long as the prices that they come to are half as high. And so that's the idea, that any supply of money is optimal because it meets this technical condition that all trades can be done with that amount of money that people wish to do in society. It just depends upon the height of prices.
All right, having said that, and that is a very useful distinction between optimal meaning efficient and optimal in the sense of technically it works and doesn't require the infusion of more money. How then can you reconcile, at least in the popular mind, the idea that strictly speaking, a given quantity of money can perform the function of money, can facilitate all the transactions we want to facilitate? How do we reconcile that with, on the other hand, saying that, well, private enterprise will just keep on creating money without even referring to this issue of, well, we already have enough to facilitate transactions. They're just going to keep on producing it until their profits wear out. How do these two things relate to each other?
Right. Well, I think it's a general relationship between technical features of a good and the subjective value we have for this good. So this is always an aspect of how we choose with respect to things. There are technical features of these goods that we value for their usefulness, and then there's the subjective value that we have for the good. And we can subjectively value these goods in a way that incorporates their technical features but goes beyond it. And so this is true of all the goods that we value. They all have technical properties. And yet, for example, let's say we take an apple. So an apple has a particular number of calories or a taste and so on and so forth. But it might be that one person eats an apple a day and another person just subjectively wants to eat one apple a week and so on and so forth. So to satisfy our preferences for things, production of apples couldn't just meet some technical condition. It would have to meet both the technical condition and our subjective valuations for the thing.
All right, so looking back on the discussion then, we've established that under a private enterprise system, we would have profit-making business producing money in the same way that it produces everything else. And we've noted that it has certain incentives. It will produce, it will use economic calculation. The concept that Mises talked about in his famous article about the problems with socialism, in order to determine the quantity that it should be producing of the money, in the same way that any producer of any good makes a determination of how much of something it ought to produce. All right, so in other words, the quantity of money is regulated by profit. So there's an incentive to produce at a certain level. Now, how does that compare to the incentives that face either a central bank or a government when they're issuing money?
Right. Well, these issues of fiat paper money by a central government or a central bank, that issue, of course, cannot be regulated by profit. If the central bank, if the Fed were to take the rule that we'll produce all the fiat paper money possible as long as it's still profitable to produce more, well, then they'll hyperinflate the currency because if it costs, say, 25 cents for them to print a dollar bill, they'll just keep printing dollar bills, earning 75 cents profit on each one. And then when the additional money supply leads to the bidding up of their input prices, so that now the paper and ink and so on costs $2 to print a $1 bill, they'll print a $5 bill. And then they'll print a $100 bill and then a $1,000 bill, and we get Zimbabwe. And the same kind of problem exists for banks issuing money substitutes that aren't backed by a money reserve. This is because banks issue these checking account balances to their customers by extending them loans. And so they earn the interest on the loan, which is profitable for them. And yet to write, account balances, these loan balances into their accounts cost them next to nothing. So again, a bank must have a policy rule that limits their issue of fiduciary media, these unbacked money substitutes. Otherwise, they would bankrupt the bank.
So in other words, they have what we would consider to be, from an economic point of view, an arbitrary rule.
Right. That's exactly right. A rule that would never be imposed upon the general system of production of any other good.
So in the Liberty Classroom course you have on Austrian economics, you make this point and you say that the issuance of money is determined by policy, whereas in the market it's determined, as everything is, by profit and loss, which is a shorthand for basically what society wants to be produced. And so when you say that, this is not a compliment. When you say it has to be determined by policy, it means it has to be determined basically arbitrarily.
Yes, that's correct. Arbitrarily with respect to what is efficiently satisfying our preferences in society. That's correct.
What about the boom-bust cycle? How is the boom and bust cycle the business cycle, how is that affected by the separation of money and state? Now, for people who say, well, we had booms and busts in the 19th century, let me refer you to my resource page, tomwoods.com/panics, and that will leave out the 19th century for now. I want to know, from your point of view, moving ahead into the future, what would we see different in terms of cyclical patterns in the economy?
Right. So if we had private production of money along the lines that we've discussed, then there could not be monetary inflation or credit expansion. The supply of credit would be determined by people's time preferences as they lend to banks and then banks intermediate the credit to borrowers. And people's demand for money, as we've seen, would be regulated by their desire to have the medium of exchange. And so it isn't possible in a private system like this for there to be the fuel that generates the boom. Now, it is true, of course, that even in the system of that we're describing, that there would be what Murray Rothbard liked to call business fluctuations. There would still be some industries that rise and other industries that fall, but we wouldn't see this economy-wide process of lengthening out the entire capital structure of the economy in the boom and then shortening it through liquidation and bankruptcy and so on, unemployment and et cetera in the bust.
If that's true, then this is the most important economic reform that could possibly be made, pretty much, right?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, it's and it also has the advantage of limiting the extent to which the state can command resources, because they use monetary inflation to support their debt issues, and this gives them much greater command over resources than if they had to rely just on taxes.
Well, I'd like people to read your entire exposition. And as I've said before, talk about pearls before swine. You delivered this before a room full of congressmen. But what a gem it is. I really think that someday a libertarian historian is going to be going through the old records and saying, hold on a minute, wait a minute, I just made an unbelievable discovery. A guy made the case for the private production of money sitting there in a committee room of the U.S. House of Representatives. I can't believe this occurred, but the records don't lie, right? I mean, look, there it is, right in black and white. Jeff, thanks for your time today. I want to urge people to check out your full testimony, because it really is the full argument here, and I link to it at an easy link to remember, tomwoods.com/money. Jeff, you are a gem. I can't say that enough. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Tom. And better than some historian in the future finding out about what I wrote in the past would be if we actually adopt these reforms.
Yeah, right, of course.
Forget about what the history was, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, then the historians can say, well, you know what I think the tipping point was? That Herbiner remark, that Herbiner speech that he gave. All right. Thanks again, Jeff.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, everybody. Wait till you hear what's coming up tomorrow. But first, remember, the big Woodsland news is the release of my new book, Real Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. Find out more about it at realdissent.com. I narrated the audiobook myself, and you can get a free copy of the audiobook via tomwoodsaudio.com. And of course, if you appreciate all this content I'm putting out 5 days a week, become a supporting listener of the show, get so many benefits and goodies you won't believe it, including the Kindle edition of my new book, Real Dissent. Do that before you forget over at supportinglisteners.com. Remember, I'll see you in Boise, Idaho this Saturday, October 25th. Get the details at tomwoods.com/events. All right, so what are we doing tomorrow? By popular demand, it's Bob Murphy on Ebola in a free society. Whoa! That's going to be some good stuff, man. You're going to want to tune in for that. And if you're afraid you might miss it, that's what subscription is for. You can get a free subscription to the show, of course, over on iTunes or Stitcher. We've got the links to do that very easily over at tomwoodsradio.com. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.